coming up on Star Stuff. A new study claims every star in the galaxy has at least one planet. Russia's crippled Phobos Grunt Mars probe crashes back to Earth. And discovery of a rare gamma-ray binary star system. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
A new study indicates just about every star in the Milky Way galaxy is most likely orbited by at least one planet, and there's a good chance that planet is closer in size to the Earth than to Jupiter. With our galaxy containing some 200 billion stars, the findings mean extrasolar planets, or exoplanets, are far more numerous than previously thought, increasing the possibility of life existing beyond Earth. Writing in the journal Nature, Dr. Arnaud Cassin from the Institute of Astrophysics in Paris, together with fellow researchers, say planets orbiting stars in our galaxy appears to be the rule rather than the exception. Their study concluded some 62% of stars have planets similar to Earth, about 17% host Jupiter-mass planets, and 52% would have planets about the size of Neptune. They also determined that a typical solar system should have about four planets orbiting a star in the terrestrial zone, which is the distance from the star where you can find solid planets. In our solar system, that means planets like Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. They also found that on average, there are at least 1.6 planets in an area surrounding a star corresponding to the area between Venus and Saturn. Cassin and colleagues reached their conclusions using a planet-detecting technique called gravitational microlensing, in which light from a distant object is bent and amplified by the gravity of the foreground object acting like a magnifying glass. This technique detects planets orbiting a star between 0.5 and 10 times the Sun-Earth distance, what astronomers refer to as one astronomical unit, or 1 AU. Because the technique's good for this sort of work, it allowed astronomers to find planets orbiting stars in their habitable zones, the so-called Goldilocks zone, where water can exist as a liquid. It's not too hot and not too cold, liquid water being an essential prerequisite for life as we know it. Cassin and colleagues scanned some 100 million stars which were detected using telescopes in Chile and New Zealand. The 500 best candidates were studied at high resolution over 6 years, with scientists eventually finding 10 examples of microlensing planets. Cassin and colleagues found the microlensing results complemented existing transit and radial velocity measurements, which have discovered around 1,000 exoplanets so far. The radial velocity technique detects a slight wobble in a star caused by the gravitational pull of an orbiting planet. The transit method, the method used by NASA's Kepler Space Telescope in its planet-hunting mission, measures tiny periodic dips in the brightness of a star as a planet orbits in front of it, as seen from Earth. Planetary scientist Dr. Simon O'Toole from the Australian Astronomical Observatory says the new findings mean the chances of life appearing anywhere in the galaxy is likely to increase astronomically.
Their claim is that every star in the Milky Way should have at least one planet orbiting it, and the most likely kind of planet is an Earth-like planet, simply because there are more planets as you go to lower and lower masses. So if you keep going down to lower and lower masses, you will eventually get a number close to 100%. So that's basically their claim. You know, it sort of comes down to the statistics, and their calculations all seem to be quite good. I mean, there's a lot of information in the supplementary material that they provide there, but I think that, you know, it's still based, they've got three detections, or three planets that they've detected, and from that, they have still extrapolated quite a long way. I mean, I'm not saying that they're necessarily wrong, and in fact, their work does correspond reasonably well with what other people have been finding recently, particularly based on things like Kepler and the HARPS instrument, and even some of the work that our group here in Australia has done. They're very, very similar sorts of results. I think that the Swiss team who used the HARPS instrument in Chile, they found about 50% of stars will have planets orbiting within 100 days, with an orbital period of 100 days. So these guys are looking a little bit further out than that, so right out to beyond the...
I think they go out to Saturn, don't they?
They go out to about Saturn, which is roughly 10 AU. Saturn is a bit inside 10 AU, or astronomical units, that is. It's a very interesting result if it's true, but I'm not 100% convinced that they can really make the claim that every one star, or more bound, that the title of the paper is one or more bound planets per Milky Way star from microlensing observations. Really like to believe that it's actually the case.
So, all right, you think it's
interesting? Because it means it'll keep me in a job for longer.
What do you think? The solar system's the first topic I studied at uni. Planets are such fun.
They're awesome.
What is the significance of knowing that there are so many planets?
What is the significance? Well, it means that the chances for life forming or appearing elsewhere in the galaxy just go up astronomically. So the more planets you have, I mean, there are 200 billion stars in the Milky Way. If you have a planet on average around every single one of them, that's 200 billion planets. That means that the chances of life occurring is, you know, very, very high, quite amazingly high.
I guess even in our own solar system, you look at planets like Venus and Mars, and they're not all that far from the habitable zone.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't want to live there.
You wouldn't want to live there, exactly. And the
Moon would probably be considered a small planet in its own right. Yeah. You wouldn't want to live there either.
Exactly.
And it is in the habitable zone.
It is in the habitable zone, but it hasn't got an atmosphere. So, I mean, habitable zone still relies on assumptions of the properties of the planet. So it's got to be terrestrial, so rocky, and it's got to have an atmosphere that's not too dense and not too thin, you know, similar to, say, Venus or Mars, that's too dense or too thin. So, you know, just because a star has a planet doesn't mean it has life, and just because the planet is in the habitable zone doesn't mean that it's habitable. But the more planets we find, the more likely we'll find planets in the habitable zone, and the more planets that we find in the habitable zone, the more likely it is that one of them is in fact habitable.
Does this mean we should be looking at somewhere like our neighbouring star system, Alpha Centauri, to look for planets around one of those three or all of those three stars that make up that system?
Well, we certainly should be, because it's the brightest, most nearby system. So certainly, and bright because it means you get more flux and you can get a more significant detection, etc. But nearby because, you know, potentially we could, you know, one day go there, haha. But yeah, I certainly think so. And people are doing it. There are currently projects where they're basically staring at both of those two, the two main stars, Alpha Centauri A and Alpha Centauri B. They're in a sort of a tighter binary with an orbit of about 80 years. And they're staring at those looking for planets. So far as I'm aware, there hasn't been any clear detection. I mean, we include it as part of our program with the Anglo-Australian Telescope, and we don't have any clear sign of a planet orbiting either of those two stars. Proxima Centauri, which is the third star in the system, it's a lot fainter. It's really, really, really faint. So it's a lot harder to observe. And in fact, it's not even 100% clear that that star is bound. So it's actually orbiting around the outside of the two. There's some evidence, it's not really clear, that it may not be complete. Like, they may be moving through the sky together, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're orbiting, that the Proxima Centauri is orbiting the other two. So that one's a lot harder, and so I think that's probably received a bit less attention because it's quite hard to observe. It's faint for the kind of observations that we normally do. It's very, very faint.
That's what, a red dwarf?
It's a red dwarf. But
the other two are orange stars, aren't they?
Orange stars. Well, Alpha Centauri A is very sun-like, in fact. Slightly heavier than the sun, but only by 5 to 10%.
And it's the one that's the second star in the pointer?
It's the second star in the pointer, that's right.
That's planetary scientist Dr. Simon O'Toole from the Australian Astronomical Observatory. Astronomers believe the findings mean there could be up to 5 times as many planets in the galaxy as originally thought. And while most of the planets are not likely to have life, scientists are now hoping there may be at least one out there which could support not just life, but intelligent life. More from the ABC's Felicity Ogilvie.
One of the telescopes being used is on the outskirts of Hobart and is run by scientists from the University of Tasmania like John Greenhill.
Mostly we see planets a bit heavier than Earth, which we call super-Earths, and we find that there are probably more of those than there are stars in the galaxy, and since there are something like 600 billion stars in our galaxy, that means that there are more than 600 billion planets a bit more massive than Earth, and there are probably almost a lot more, in fact, Earth-mass planets around it out there.
Another member of the team from the University of Tasmania, Stefan Dieters, says most of the newly discovered planets are too cold to support life.
In our research, the closest Earth-like planet would be this frozen super-Earth, but it's too far away from a star to be warm enough to hold life. So it's Earth-like in the terms of that it's rocky with water on it, probably. We don't actually know the composition, but that's our guess. Other methods have found planets in the the just right zone, the Goldilocks zone, where the temperatures are not too cold, not too hot, and where water can be a liquid on the surface. And there's about three or four of those, maybe.
Dr. Dieters says the Earth-like planets are hundreds of light years away, making it unlikely that they'll be explored. But Dr. John Greenhill believes there is intelligent life out there, and his search for other planets started after hearing the thoughts of the UK astronomer Fred Hoyle.
I was inspired by Fred Hoyle many, many years ago when I was a young farmer on the northwest coast of Tasmania. I used to look up at the stars because he concluded that there must be huge numbers of planets, almost certainly, that there's probably life on some of them, and he wondered whether somewhere else in the universe there was a cricket team that could beat the Australian.
That's Dr. John Greenhill from the University of Tasmania, ending that report by the ABC's Felicity Ogilvie. Russia's failed Phobos Grunt Mars probe has finally re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, burning up as it plummeted into the South Pacific Ocean off the Chilean coastline on Sunday. Debris from the spacecraft fell into the sea some 1,250 kilometres west of the coastal island of Wellington. The crippled probe failed to leave low Earth orbit following its November 8th launch from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan. Russian media reports claim it's still not clear whether all parts of the spacecraft that didn't burn up during atmospheric re-entry had fallen in the same area. Apparently, Russian military officials have been quoted as saying ballistics experts have calculated that the debris could have fallen anywhere in a broad area centered on Brazil. The Russian space agency Roscosmos had said that debris from its doomed 14-ton spacecraft, which included 12 tons of highly toxic hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide rocket fuel, might fall into the Atlantic Ocean about midway between Brazil and West Africa. But to be honest, who knows? After all, last week those same Russian officials were reported as claiming the spacecraft was likely to come down in the Indian Ocean west of Jakarta. But you can't really blame Russian mission control for these predictions. You see, constant changes in the altitude and density of the Earth's upper atmosphere caused by fluctuations in solar activity make it just about impossible to know the exact time and location of atmospheric re-entry. The $165 million spacecraft was designed to retrieve soil samples from the Martian moon Phobos. It was also going to deploy a small Chinese microsatellite around Mars. It would have been Russia's first interplanetary mission in over two decades. Experts said the falling space junk posed little risk, with the probe's aluminium fuel tanks expected to burn up high in the atmosphere. Hydrazine fuel boils at 113 degrees Celsius, and the nitrogen tetroxide oxidizer boils at just 21 degrees C, meaning both would have evaporated fairly quickly and at fairly high altitudes once the tanks were gone. Some 20 to 30 small pieces of debris, mostly made out of stainless steel and titanium, with a total weight of about 200 kilograms, would have survived the heat of atmospheric re-entry. Somewhat more troubling is that this would have included a supply of highly radioactive cobalt-57. And of course, the sample return re-entry capsule, specifically designed to return to Earth, would have obviously survived the re-entry as well. More from the ABC's Tony Eastley.
Russian plans went awry when the craft's booster engine failed to fire and attempts to contact the spacecraft from the ground failed. Dr. Alice Gorman specialises in space archaeology at Flinders University in South Australia. Dr. Alice Gorman, tell me a little about this Phobos grunt.
Well, very sadly, it got to low Earth orbit. It had a number of orbital manoeuvres to make from there. And the engines didn't ignite, and it couldn't leave low Earth orbit. So it's pretty quickly that the mission came to an end once it got to that point. Communication was lost as well. There were some communication issues. And there it was, this spacecraft couldn't complete its mission and obviously going to re-enter the atmosphere. It's surprisingly hard to tell this stuff. You would think it would be easier than it is. Basically, what we've had to do is track its orbit and where it goes across land, where there are people watching, either space agencies formally tracking it or independent observers, get verification. Okay, it's about to be seen in the next spot. Has anyone seen it? Yes, they have. Move on to the next spot. And, of course, everyone's watching the altitude and the speed and all of that. At a certain point, you don't see it anymore where you expect to see it. And so then you say, okay, is it down or not? Has anyone seen it come down? If it's over the ocean, of course, if there's nobody to watch it, then that's a little more difficult.
How much of this spacecraft actually gets to come back through the atmosphere?
It's estimated that maybe about 200 kilograms would come back down. Usually what survives from these re-entries is very robust materials, particularly things like titanium. But in this particular spacecraft, they used a lot of aluminium, and that melts at about half the temperature. So some of the parts that we might have normally expected to see, like fuel tanks, were not going to re-enter in this case. So it's the more robust elements that can actually survive the tremendous heating that you get as it burns through the atmosphere.
Does it pose much danger to humans?
Again, this was a bit of an interesting one. Normally, a spacecraft which re-enters would have used up most of its fuel, but because the fuel didn't ignite, the engines didn't go, so the fuel tanks were full. And this was an interesting issue because these fuels are fairly toxic. So there were concerns that this might come back through to Earth, and this could pose a danger to people if it landed in some populated area. The risk of it landing in a populated area is always going to be very low. So while people were concerned about that, it was fairly clear that it would be long odds, you know, if it did come down where people were and those chemicals and substances, you know, created a risk.
This failed mission has received quite a deal of publicity, but of course, space junk falls to Earth quite regularly, as I understand it.
Probably, you know, every week there would be little bits and pieces of stuff falling back to Earth. All of the debris that's in low Earth orbit will be pulled back in by the atmosphere eventually. In Esperance, just before Christmas, people witnessed some bits of stuff falling down. So what it is about the particular missions that catch media attention and become turned into stories of risk and calamity is kind of interesting. Some of the bigger satellites, obviously, are always going to catch public attention.
That's space archaeologist Dr. Alice Gorman from Flinders University speaking with the ABC's Tony Eastley. Phobos Grunt was one of five botched Russian launches last year that marred celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's pioneering first human spaceflight. In an apparent attempt to deflect blame, Russian space officials last week raised the possibility of sabotage. Scientists using NASA's Fermi Space Telescope have discovered an extremely rare gamma-ray binary star system. A binary system consists of two stars orbiting each other. In this case, one of those stars is either a black hole or a neutron star, while the other is a giant O-class star, about 20 times the mass of our Sun. The discovery by the Fermi-LAT collaboration opens up a new window on these extremely high-energy sources in the cosmos. The collaboration's Dr. Robin Corbett, a senior research scientist from the University of Maryland at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, says while many X-ray binaries have been discovered, surprisingly only a handful give off gamma rays. Writing in the journal Science, Corbett and colleagues report that binary star systems with gamma ray emissions from either a neutron star or a black hole are extremely rare, even though binary evolution models predict dozens of similar systems should exist in our galaxy. Trouble is, so far, only four have been detected, and they were found because they also gave off either radio waves or X-rays. But this new discovery is the first to be detected simply by looking for nothing more than gamma-ray radiation directly. In other words, it's a new way to find these weird critters. According to Corbett, it's hard to study gamma rays because you don't get gamma-ray photons coming into your detector very easily. Furthermore, the Earth's atmosphere also blocks out both X-rays and gamma rays. But the Fermi Space Observatory's LAT, or Large Area Telescope, is much more powerful than any previous generations of these instruments, and so scientists were able to use it to hunt for these elusive gamma-ray binaries, which should be out there. Fermi's detected well over 1,000 gamma-ray sources in the sky so far, but these are usually either quasars or pulsars. the newly detected binary, named 1FGL J1018.6-5856, was discovered 16,308 light-years away near the galactic plane of the Milky Way. Corbett and colleagues knew their newly detected gamma-ray source was in a binary system because the emissions were modulated. In other words, they were getting brighter and dimmer in regular 16.6-day cycles. Follow-up observations using NASA's Swift Space Telescope also detected X-ray emissions from the same source, but they were much fainter than the gamma-ray emissions. So what are they seeing? Well, any binary star system involves two stars orbiting each other around a common center of gravity. In an X-ray binary, material from the companion star is falling onto the neutron star or black hole. In the process, it releases gravitational energy, which heats up the material, eventually giving off high-energy X-rays.
But because gamma rays have so much more energy than X-rays, you can't make gamma rays by just heating things up. You have to have what they call non-thermal mechanisms. You have to have other ways of getting the energy out of the system. And typically they may involve things like having a shock. You know, we have a change in physical conditions. So one model for this new binary that we've found is that there is a very strong wind coming out of the regular star, kind of like there is a wind coming out of our sun. But in this case, we're dealing with a kind of heavier, brighter, hotter object. The wind is much, much denser. We think there may be a pulsar hidden away inside the system that also has its own wind coming out of it. So the suspicion is that there is these two powerful winds colliding into each other. They shock, form a shock, and then there is a mechanism by which particles can get accelerated as they bounce backwards and forwards across this shock. They can then convert light coming from the star by a process which goes under the technical term of inverse Compton scattering, and it converts the very energetic particles interact with the light from the ordinary star, and they make the gamma rays. So that's why they're relatively rare compared to the X-ray binaries, because you need to have this additional mechanism going on. You can't just exploit the big gravity well of the neutron star or the black hole on its own.
So it's sort of like a turbocharger, a supercharger. It's just giving extra momentum to the stellar winds.
Kind of a collision between the two winds.
Yeah.
So the neutron star is probably a pulsar, but we don't see it pulsing. If it was on its own without the wind being there, we think we would see pulsations in the radio, an X-ray, and gamma ray, and so on. But it's hidden there behind this dense wind, which makes it impossible to see what the real engine is, or very difficult at least. We have actually, several people in our team have tried looking for the sign of this pulsar there, and so far we haven't seen it. That's not too surprising, and it still seems to be a very good model for what may be going on inside the system.
That's Dr. Robin Corbett, a senior research scientist with the University of Maryland and currently assigned to NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. The crew aboard the International Space Station were forced to take emergency action over the weekend, moving the orbiting outpost to avoid a collision with a piece of space junk. Russian mission controllers say the station's average altitude was raised by 1.5 kilometres to 391.4 kilometres. Mission managers say the manoeuvre was needed to keep the ISS away from the remains of an out-of-control Iridium telecommunications satellite. The US Iridium 33 satellite was struck by the disused Russian Cosmos 2251 military satellite back in 2009. The collision happened at an altitude of about 800 kilometres, resulting in a huge cloud of space debris. China has carried out the first rocket launch for the new year, with the Long March 4B successfully blasting off from the Taiyuan Space Center in Shaanxi Province, carrying two satellites. The primary payload was the 3-ton Chinese-built Zhaiwan 3 Earth Observation Satellite. It'll provide Beijing with new high-resolution survey mapping capabilities down to almost 2 meters in resolution. Zhaiwan 3 is also equipped with an infrared spectrometer. It was deployed into a low-Earth orbit at an altitude of 500 kilometres with an inclination of 97.5 degrees. The second payload was the Lux space-built 30-kilogram Orbcomm VesselSat-2 microsatellite. It follows last October's launch of VesselSat-1, and will be used to relay maritime data. And time now, once again, to turn our eyes to the skies with Jeff White, Senior Astronomy Educator with the Powerhouse Museum Sydney Observatory. He joins us now for Skywatch.
We're going to look for the rising constellation of Orion the Hunter in the northeast. It's relatively high up and it's very close to Canis Major. As you would expect, Canis Major, the big dog, is one of the hunting dogs of Orion the Hunter. For most Australians, Kiwis and South Africans, look, it's probably easy to say, can you see the saucepan? Now, the constellations have been named predominantly from the Northern Hemisphere. In fact, they've all been named from the Northern Hemisphere. But in the Southern Hemisphere, we see them the right way up. Well, those in the North would say that they see them the right way up and we see them upside down. But, it's all relative. As we look at Orion in the Southern Hemisphere, Kiwis, Australians and South Africans don't see Orion the Hunter as easily as they see a saucepan. So look for three stars in a lovely straight line, fairly close together. And I want you to picture that those three stars make up the base of a saucepan. From one corner, you go up to the top of the saucepan, so it's just a single star, go back down along the base, up the other side, where you'll see three more star-like objects that form the handle. What you're really looking at is the belt of Orion sitting very close to the celestial equator and the sword of Orion. If you have a decent pair of binoculars or indeed a small telescope, have a look at the middle star-like object of the handle of the saucepan. And what you're looking at there is a cloud of gas and dust, perhaps 20,000 times the size of our solar system, and you are in effect looking into the maternity ward of stars, because you are seeing baby stars being born at this very minute. It is one of the most beautiful sights in the night sky, but you do need a very good pair of binoculars or a small telescope. The object itself is called M42, meaning it was the 42nd object in a catalogue developed by Charles Messier, who created a list of red herrings, things not to look at if you were looking for a comet. And this was the 42nd object. And it really is, at this time of year, perfectly placed and absolutely beautiful. M42 is also, of course, better known as the Orion Nebula. The word nebula is simply Latin for cloud, because as astronomers start to look through their telescopes, these things look like clouds. And they are, of course, the birth and later the death of stars. From the saucepan, the base of which sits on the celestial equator, drop down ever so slightly and you'll see one of the few stars in the night sky to show any sort of identifiable colour. And what you're looking at there is a star with a spectacular Arabic name, which has been mispronounced so long that we now call it Betelgeuse. It was originally something along the lines of Aptelyaza, meaning shoulder of the giant. Betelgeuse is a truly big star, but it's right on the cusp of being a truly spectacular star as well. You see, it's 600 light years away, so it's not exactly close. It's 1,000 times the diameter of the Sun and several times more massive. How massive it is, however, there's still a bit of debate about that, but it's on the limit. It may actually, at the end of its life, which it's in its final stages now, catastrophically collapse and explode as a supernova. We don't know if that is the case or whether or not it'll simply become a red supergiant, shed its outer layers and die a graceful, beautiful death to form something called a planetary nebula and expose what's, if you like, the leftover thermonuclear heart, a white dwarf. So Betelgeuse is dying, and the typical colour of a large dying star is red. Don't expect to see traffic light red. It is, in fact, more like a golden, orangey, pinky, reddish. If you can see anything that's bright and of those colours, you've found Betelgeuse. As we leave Orion the Hunter, who came to a fairly sticky end at the sting of the giant scorpion Scorpius, we head towards the north, but down a little bit to about 38, 40 degrees or so above the north by northeast horizon. And there's another slightly orange-reddish-looking star called Aldebaran. And it's the brightest star in the constellation of Taurus the Bull, which is perhaps the oldest of all the constellations. Constellations have been around for a very long time. In the 2nd century AD, Claudius Ptolemy created a catalogue of constellations, about 48 of them. We've been adding to it ever since. Now, these constellations have come to us via ancient Arabic cultures. They've then gone from there to Greek cultures, and then after the Renaissance, they've spread out and, if you like, dominated our worldview of the night sky. So we've largely ignored cultures from other areas of the world. But Taurus is generally accepted to be one of the older of all the constellations because it's a beast of burden, if you like, in its barest form. But according to some mythology, it was, in fact, Jupiter, king of the gods, in the form of a bull, who was carrying a young maiden on his back to a nearby island. What a bizarre story. Anyway, Aldebaran looks as though it's part of a V-shaped group of stars pointing back down towards the horizon. It's actually between us and the rest of the stars in that V, which is actually a group of young stars called the Hyades, and that's an open cluster. But if you can see the upside-down V with the fairly bright orange-reddish star at the end of the V, it's the eye of the bull. And then, of course, it has two very long horns. You see, the longer the horns, the more fertile he was, according to mythology, pointing back down to the horizon on the northeast towards the constellation of Gemini. But Gemini's just too low for us to see at the moment.
That's the Powerhouse Museum's senior astronomy educator, Jeff Wyatt. For more details and sky maps, go to sydneyobservatory.com.au. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word and in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.